once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. I say that with some degree of hopefulness that boys and girls would be interested in an economics program. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and on the line with me I have...
Jeff McClure.
And we are hopefully going to be talking today about things financial, economic, staying as much out of politics as we possibly can. Although, when politics touches economics, we'll talk about it.
Well, a politic is a whole lot of eight-legged arachnids that are...
Parasitic?
Parasitic, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's poly means lots. Ticks are certainly something I don't want around me.
So we won't talk about them.
We won't talk about politics. No. All right. So this is the Personal Wealth Coach. It's an economics radio program, as you might have guessed. There is a coincidence involved in that name. That is not exactly a coincidence. It was planned. There's an SEC registered investment advisory firm by the same name, the Personal Wealth Coach, that offers fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth. And that firm has two principals that are also the hosts of this program. Talking of parasites, you got hosts now.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we are. And we've got two hats. We give investment advice at a fiduciary level in our professional role at work. And here we're giving educational information. It would be nice if we could give fiduciary advice on the air, but that would be completely impossible.
And not to mention
what?
Illegal.
Illegal, yes, because we don't know you guys. In order to give investment advice, we have to tailor it specifically to you, and it has to be in your best interest. We don't know what your interests are. So what we're going to do instead during the radio program is talk to you about educational matters, the things to build your toolbox in the financial world so that when you come to situations, you can either fix them or build them better based on the knowledge that you hold. How's that?
Sounds pretty cool to me.
You want to do the next one?
Well, let's see. We don't pay for this radio program. On the other hand, we're not paid for this radio program. And on the other hand, which means we have at least three hands.
At least.
We do pay for advertising on KTEM for the radio program.
Which is, I don't know. I mean, a lot of our clients listen to this program, so it's not completely selfless. But the reason why we do the radio program is because we feel like Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith is the father of capitalism, talking about the invisible hand. The more people that have better knowledge about this, the better the entire society will be.
To that degree, we are altruistic as well as a fiduciary.
Yes.
Both of which are words that people generally don't understand but sound really cool when you say them.
If you cut them in half and like meld them together, most people wouldn't even know it wasn't a word. Altruistery?
Yes, it could be.
Yeah. You want to do the deem?
Oh, yeah, that's my favorite one. The information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness
of the word complete.
Yes, of said information.
Yeah.
Said
or heard information.
Or spoken.
Yes. One other thing to add, because I missed it in our... In my statement just a moment ago, I said that the firm that shares the hosts is an SEC registered investment advisory firm. That doesn't mean that the SEC has in any way approved us. They are simply the regulatory authority through which our firm files. The government doesn't approve things. They disapprove things quite quickly, and that's just something to be aware of. But we're telling you that because those are the folks that you need to talk to if you think that we're saying something that's dangerous or inappropriate in our educational content. There you go. How's that?
Content. That sounds cool. Well, I guess we can talk about the markets.
Let's do it.
The markets were weird this week.
On
the surface, they were weird. If you dig down deep inside of them and you understand what's going on, at least you understand what the reporters say is going on, which I think is pretty accurate in the Wall Street Journal, they make a peculiar kind of sense. The S&P 500 stock index started off the year with a real bang. I mean, it was up over 2% for the week. And that puts it 17% up from a year ago. The rise of the S&P 500 continued despite what went on in Washington and despite the fact that, and we'll talk about this more later, the S&P 500 continued to rise on Friday despite the fact that the Labor Department announced that the economy lost 140,000 jobs in December. Now, that's the first time in 7 months we've had a job loss, and could be considered to be really bad news because we went from roughly 360 new jobs in November to losing 140,000 jobs in December.
360 jobs? Or was there another number that goes with 360,000? Okay.
Lots of jobs. We've been slowing down in our number of new jobs in the economy each month, and we'd predicted that there might be a dip in January, possibly in December, and sure enough, we get a dip in December.
And it was easy to predict that because we're seeing the transmission of the virus increase and the death rate go up, and that causes, or at least the news of it, to go up, which causes people to not go out and shop, which causes less money to go into the shopholders' hands, which causes them to lay people off.
And the peculiarity is that the market went up in each of those events. Now, there are several ways of looking at that. One is to say, hey, the people who are investing, even short term, are looking 6 months out into the future and saying the second half of 2021 is going to be really good.
You're breaking up. Can you check where your phone is? The second half of what?
Second half of 2021.
Yeah,
has potential to be economically really good. And that's one reason that in earnings would go up, and that would justify people investing more money. The other side of looking at that is maybe people are just investing in the market as it goes up because the market's going up, and they don't care about the economy.
There's a lot of that happening. We're very much aware of that, but
so it's really an odd thing. The other side of it is that there's more sides to this than we have hands. Even though there's the two of us with four hands and four arms, I guess if we each have two forearms, that'd make a lot of arms. Anyway, the fact is the stock market revival of value also went up. The other end of the S&P 500, the S&P 500, let me explain, is composed of relatively large cap stocks. The smallest stocks in the S&P 500 are what are called mid-cap stocks, mid-size stocks when it comes to market valuation. Mid-cap value is the opposite to large-cap growth in the S&P 500. Large-cap growth is what has been driving the S&P 500 during the year, with a few companies like now Tesla, Google, which is now Alphabet. It's very confusing to change names like that.
Yeah.
Apple, Facebook, driving the market higher and higher on some really absurd prices in the upper 10 or so stocks in the S&P 500. But at the other end of the S&P 500 are the mid-cap stocks, and value is the opposite of growth. So mid-cap value is the other end. The mid-cap value, the CRSP mid-cap value index, rose 2.83% for the week, which means it rose more than the S&P 500, which is an unusual thing. In other words, people are beginning, from our perspective at least, to return to some degree of sanity and realize that there's stocks that are underpriced out there, and they're buying those stocks rather than buying the overpriced stocks, which is kind of a hopeful thing. It'd be interesting to see how this comes out. The important thing, there's a lot of important things here, but one of the important things to recognize is when the stock market behaves the way it's behaving right now, when we have record numbers of new investors opening accounts, when we have record margin investment where people are borrowing money to buy stocks, historically, it has resulted in a major correction at some point. Now, how far out some point is, that's obviously very questionable, but
yeah, the word irrational exuberance was used multiple years before we saw the drop in the market.
Frankly, having been around a few years and observed the market for a few years, I can tell you that the beginning of 2021 looks an awful lot like the beginning of 2000. We got a new president. We got a lot of optimism. We got the market soaring. And there's another argument on the other side of that about interest rates, but we'll get to that later. Suffice to say, the market went up despite everything that was going on. And everything that was going on during the week typically would have caused the market to go down historically, but it didn't. It went up, which is an interesting thing altogether. The yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which is the benchmark for the bond market, obviously was pretty exciting. It busted through the 1% barrier.
That's something we've been waiting for it to come back to do.
It jumped 21% relatively, and it ended the week with a yield of 1.120. That's pretty astonishing. A 30-year Treasury bond jumped up to 1.87. That's significant because the 30-year Treasury bond is one of the things that mortgage lenders look at when they determine what their mortgage interest rates are going to be. And I noticed that the best mortgage interest rates listed on bankrate.com, some of them had jumped up to 3%. Which means that the record low mortgage refinance rates and mortgage purchase rates may be a thing of the past at this point. We'll have to see. Crude oil is another thing we follow to see what the economy, see what crude oil prices seem to suggest the economy is doing. West Texas Intermediate crude soared 8.7% in the week at $52.73, which is where it was in November of 2019.
And there's some good reason for that to happen when it did. Saudi Arabia just announced that it was going to cut back by about 1 million barrels of oil a day. When they do it, usually other countries will do it as well. So there's less supply out there, and we're anticipating higher demand in the future after enough people have the vaccine that the economy starts acting like it did before the pandemic.
So in essence, the stock market is acting like there's no crisis, there's no pandemic, everything is rosy and smiling and happy. And of course, the stock market and the other markets tend to anticipate things about 6 months out. The question is, will everything go that well? Which brings out the pessimists in us, because when the market is really, really high and things are going really, really well in the market,
it's our job to get pessimistic.
Yeah, we tend to look around the corner and say, what could go wrong here? And start look for what could go wrong. When the market is really, really down and unreasonably low, we start looking for everything that could go right. And yeah. That's it.
I recommend that people look back or listen back. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Go back to March and April and listen to our radio programs. And we are glowingly optimistic about the future of the market. We're not glowingly optimistic about the future of the economy. And now we're kind of flipping that. We're much more optimistic about the future of the economy and not so optimistic about the future of the market, because the market is now significantly higher than it was pre-pandemic, when we've really only had negatives during the pandemic. That means we're overpriced. We were talking about the market mildly overpriced at the beginning of 2000 or 2020. So now it is significantly higher than that. The S&P 500, the price to earnings ratio in February for the S&P 500 was hovering right around 20. What does that mean? That means 20 years of earnings would buy back the price of a share. I know doing that with an index is weird because it's all averaged out, but it's a good number. The lower that is, the more undervalued we consider it to be. At the bottom of the market, when we were talking in mid-March, when the market had crashed, we were down to about 17.5 as the price-to-earnings ratio. So we lost 3 out of 20, or 2.5. The S&P 500 is now at about 27. So 27 as a price to earnings ratio puts it in the same range that what we were looking at in the year 2000 with the dot-com bubble. It doesn't rationally make sense. And some portions of the market are near the 1,000 price-to-earnings ratio. So, I mean, looking at Tesla, it's hard for me not to be excited about a company that's so innovative. But it's also hard for me to look at that price-to-earnings ratio and say that makes any sense at all. It's going to have to grow by a huge amount as far as its internal structure goes in order to be worth that. It's, you know, if we look at the top 20 best-selling automobiles right now, none of them are Tesla. And yet Tesla is the most valuable car manufacturing company on the planet. So you wanted to say something.
Well, there's another aspect of the stock market that's important to recognize. One is, and it is that there's an old balance point that has proven to be fairly historically accurate, that when the dividend yield on the S&P 500 is higher than the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury, the market is undervalued. And the dividend yield on the S&P 500 is like 1.5, 1.2, 1.5, I don't remember. It's up in the ones, 1.5%. The S&P 5, the 10-year Treasury we just mentioned had jumped to 1.12%. So if you want income and you need, and if you buy a 10-year Treasury note, you really need to be willing to hold it for 10 years to get your money back, because if interest rates go up during the 10-year period, the value of the note would drop, and if you tried to sell it on the open market, you get less than what you paid for it. Well, the same is true of the S&P 500. The thing is the S&P 500 likely to go up or down over the next 10 years? And the odds are, historically, almost every 10-year period, it's gone up. So if we look at the risk, the rational risk of owning the S&P 500 in some form or owning a 10-year Treasury note, they're about the same. So when one is paying you more than the other one, you would go with the one that pays more. And the S&P 500 is paying, has a higher dividend yield right now than does the, than is the yield on the 10-year Treasury note. So if you just bought an S&P 500, if you could buy shares in the S&P 500, which technically you can't, but in fact, you can come pretty close to doing, and you just were willing to put it away and not look at it for 10 years, the income you would receive would be higher than if you bought a 10-year Treasury note. And the 10-year Treasury note is only good as long as the S&P 500 is still viable, because that's where the taxes come from to pay the 10-year Treasury note.
Right.
So the argument is now that that interest rate argument, that historical interest rate argument, would suggest that the S&P 500 is now underpriced, while the price-to-earnings ratio would indicate that it's overpriced.
Right.
So we can say with a resounding degree of assertiveness and assurity, we don't know.
Yeah. The reason why dividends are up is because there's a lot of cash out there, and companies have been investing in research, but they're more investing in sending dividends home to people. I mentioned something there just to talk about, like, for instance, I like Tesla as a company, and people have heard me talk about them in the past. I think that they're a very innovative company. If they're profitable, that's good. They're profitable. But I mentioned there, none of the top 10 bestsellers are Tesla. None of the 25 bestsellers in 2020 from Car and Driver came out this week with the 25 best-selling automobile models for 2020. And if you tabulate up all of the Teslas delivered for the year of 2020, the number one best-selling pickup truck, just one model, sold more than all of Tesla's models put together. It's the Ford F-Series pickup truck. They sold 787,000 units in 2020, where Tesla's top quarter was 180,000. Even if you took their top quarter and multiplied it by four, it wouldn't be as much as one top-selling. And Tesla is worth significantly more than Ford Motor Company right now on the market. So there are parts of the market that are, there's no doubt that they're overpriced. Tesla doesn't pay a dividend, so we're not looking at their dividend yield and saying, why is that so high for the price-to-earnings ratio being so high? There are parts of the market that there's absolutely no doubt are overpriced. there are parts of the market that there's absolutely no doubt are underpriced. The overall average is just weird right now. So it's really hard to say if the market is overpriced or not. Got to do a lot of math to figure out how it's weighted, and the parts that are overpriced, are they significantly enough overpriced to make the underpriced overpriced as well? You see where we're coming from. It's hard to say. So the average dividend yield is high on the S&P 500, but the highest valued, the companies with the largest valuation in that index don't pay dividends. So you can say both that, number one, the portion of the market that pays dividends is underpriced, and the overall market is overpriced. But it's easier just to say, I don't know. I want to break up this reasonably energetic and interesting portion of the program to say something completely uninteresting. I'm going to quote from the Federal Reserve minutes. And then I'm going to try to translate. So here we go. Participants generally judge that the asset purchase program, as structured, was providing very significant policy accommodation.
You don't have to explain that.
I do. What they're saying there is that the bond purchase program that the Federal Reserve started during the pandemic is doing its job well. It is keeping bond liquidity high, which is part of the reason why there's a lot of cash out there. What they're saying there is that still a lot of people are selling their bonds. They're getting rid of their bonds, and the Federal Reserve is stepping in and buying them. So they have a market, and it allows people who just sold their bonds to not be afraid of getting back into bonds. So their policy accommodation, it's providing very significant policy accommodation. What is a policy for the Federal Reserve? Is to keep enough cash in the system that it doesn't freeze up, but not so much in the system that we get runaway inflation. So that's as close to a translation as you're going to get, I think. What it means is that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to buy bonds for the foreseeable future. There you go. I've broken up our really exciting portion of the program to talk about the least exciting quote you can imagine in the week that we had.
Well, one of the things that happened, though, is the interest rates on the 10-year Treasury and on the 30-year Treasury rose significantly this week, which could mean that the Fed is pulling back on its purchases of bonds, because when the Fed purchases bonds, interest rates don't go up, they go down.
That's correct.
So something is going on out there of some significance. The bond market has been cited again and again and again recently as not being truly a market at this point because the Fed is manipulating it. But the Fed may be backing off on its suppression of interest rates, which could be quite significant. Generally speaking, when the stock market gets completely carried away, and it may be getting carried away at this point, it ends when the Fed allows interest rates to rise.
And interest rates are definitely rising right now. I mean, we got the 10-year above 1%. It's still not as high as it was before the pandemic. But
it's down almost 1% from where it was a year before the pandemic.
So that is we're kind of at the halfway back up point, or near the halfway back up point, not quite there. On the bond interest rates, the market is much higher than it was prior to the pandemic. So if you want to talk about a market recovery, we're beyond the recovery and into additional growth. When it comes to the economy, we're nowhere near recovery. Do you have the statistics on the back to normal index available?
No, I don't have that right in front of me. But I do know that the major issue is jobs. And we did lose 140,000 jobs. And more importantly, Moody's is saying the unemployment rate, which was left stable at 6.7%, is probably inaccurate at this point because of some ways that the Labor Department has been calculating it the last couple of years, it's probably closer to 7.3% at this point, according to Moody's Analytics, which I think is probably accurate.
Yeah, and I've got the Moody's Analytics. They're the ones that do the back to normal index, too. We're at 74%.
Ooh, and we were in the upper 80s.
Yeah.
At one.
Yeah. We've taken a significant dip since the end of November, which is the same time period that the market has taken a significant jump upward. And that's very normal coming out of recessions. Now, something to be aware of is that while we've been warning that we might dip back into recession in the first quarter, I would put the likelihood of Europe going back into a recession in the first quarter of about 90%. I would think that they are going to be in shrink zone.
That's what I was going to say, about 90%. The reality is we could wind up back in a recession in the first quarter, and it's not because of anything the Fed is doing or anything Congress is doing. Congress did pass the Relief Act. They're probably going to, it looks like that's one of the reasons, by the way, the market is up, because it looks like that they will probably pass another one with the change in majority in the Senate.
Right.
But that kind of hides the point at this juncture. The fact is that hospitalizations due to COVID have jumped rather dramatically, very dramatically, in the last couple of weeks, which is the same pattern that occurred in England with the new variant of the virus becoming dominant. If that happens, I can tell you that there's a likely... Well, in Texas, we just got this announced last week, although it got kind of buried in the other minor things that were going on in the region.
Minor things, right.
The governor is shutting down the bars again.
Yeah.
And he's reduced the capacity in restaurants from 75% to 50%.
Do you mind if I step in here for just a moment and explain what we're talking about here in a way, hopefully that'll bring less resistance from the hearers? Why are we talking about COVID and death rates when we're economists? And the answer to that is, I'll just jump in and say this right now. My area of expertise is behavioral finance, behavioral economics. People's behavior changes when they think they might get sick when they go out. Whether or not they might get sick when they go out is simply irrelevant to the numbers. If they believe they will get sick, then it prevents them from going out, and it causes their behavior to change. And that's why we talk about this stuff. Whether or not the data on the death rate or the infection rate is correct, I can answer that kind of unilaterally. It is not correct yet. It is very vague. And one of the things that people talk to me about this, you know, that data is incorrect. They're either missing counts or they're adding counts. And my answer to that very simply is, welcome to the world of economics. The Labor Department does that. The GDP gets revised 8 or 9 times until it's marked as final. But if it was wrong the other 7 or 8 times, what's to say that the last time was correct? When you're dealing with large numbers, eventually you just say, close enough. This is why when we do vote recounts for board elections of corporations or cities or states, the votes come back at a slightly different number, because when you're dealing with lots and lots and lots of numbers, people make mistakes. So let's just say the numbers are not all there, but I would expect that deaths from COVID are going to be a higher number than what's been reported, not a lower, because the deaths from pneumonia and so on are up. That's kind of irrelevant when we're talking about the market, when we're talking about the economy. The death rate and the viral infection rate has nothing to do with the profitability of a company on the front end of it. Has a lot to do with the behavior of the buyers of whatever that seller, that company is selling. So when we see the numbers go up, the reason why we talk about them isn't to verify them or to say this number is exactly correct. If it's a widely reported number, it affects investor behavior and it affects consumer behavior. That has a direct impact on the economy. So when we see hospitalization rates go up, when we see hospitals being jammed, we don't need numbers to say that's going to cause a bit of fear to percolate through that community to say, let's not go out and shop right now. that has an effect on the economy. That's why we're talking about these numbers. The specifics of the numbers being big, we really don't even have to say the numbers just to say they're being reported as higher or record-breaking. That's going to change the economy. It doesn't matter if the numbers are right. They're being reported that way, and that will change the economy. And when it comes down to it, we don't think that the numbers are that far off. They are probably low rather than high. So there you go. That was my intense disclaimer of the numbers, but also an intense statement of they're still valid on people's belief and behavior. There you go.
That makes sense. The big thing was that the employment loss was in leisure and hospitality. And I like the headline. The headline at Moody's, which is about as apolitical as you can get, was December U.S. employment drop is all about COVID-19. And the reality is, even in manufacturing right now, they're having difficulty meeting demand. And that's a positive in that manufacturing is actually reaching capacity in many areas, and they're reaching capacity because they can't find people to work. You say, well, with all these people out of work, why can't they find people to work? And the answer is it takes skilled people to work in manufacturing.
Yeah.
You can't bring somebody in off the street and say, here, get on this, well, for example, the making of cheese is a big one where they can't find enough people to work.
Yeah.
The price of-
Let me give some good news on that front though. On manufacturing front, there's not a lot of good news out there this month. Last month, we had a little bit of good news from the month before, but the manufacturers index, the IHS market, which is not spelled the way a normal market is spelled, spelled with a K in there, just because. The purchasing managers index for the U.S. manufacturing sector rose to 57.1. Anything above 50 is growth. And the purchasing managers index, it's an index when they're asking people that buy things from manufacturers, are you ordering more or less right now? And they're ordering more right now. Germany and the United States had a pretty massive increase in the recent past up on their manufacturing order. China's had a drop in its ordering of manufactured goods. Now, let me give you a timeout there and say, this is a manufacturing purchasing index, which just means that the Chinese are not purchasing from Chinese manufacturing as fast as they were. The United States is making up for that, and so is Germany. We're buying things from China in the manufacturing world and from our own manufacturers. But a lot of stuff is made in China. So just be aware that as our economy cranks back up, it's going to benefit the Chinese as well. Go ahead.
We've got a couple of questions from John. I don't know if you got those or not. But one of them is, does the government always buy the majority of issued debt for control of our financial system from foreign? And he says gives, but I think he meant government. The government doesn't buy issued debt for control of our financial system.
Well, let's talk about what he means by that. What is issued debt? What would you say that he means by that?
Debt issued by the Treasury, and he's suggesting that the government is buying it back to control interest rates. The government doesn't buy its own debt back, or very rarely does it do that. It hasn't done it in a long time.
Now, buying its own debt back would be, you got to get the money for the extra spending that they're doing from somewhere. So they're not. Now, the Federal Reserve buys some quantity of debt that is issued by the U.S. government. And they did quite a bit of that direct from the Treasury back in March and April. But they haven't been doing a lot of that lately. So I think that's what he means, is that does the Federal Reserve buy the majority of issued debt for control? No, they don't. They don't even buy close to the majority of the debt. The only reason why they would buy debt is if there's a shortage of people willing to buy the debt, just to tell them, hey, it's okay to keep buying.
And there's tremendous cash flow into bonds right now, which means that the public in the United States and the banks in the United States and the insurance companies in the United States are buying the vast majority of issued debt by the Treasury. They want all of it they can get. You basically are in a position where As Will Rogers said, they're not so much concerned about the return on their money as they are the return of their money at this point. Now, once we get past the point where things are really scary, odds are the buying will slack off on the debt, and the buying by the public and the buying by the insurance companies and the mutual fund companies and so on. And once they stop doing that, interest rates will go up because interest rates move in the opposite direction of the price. In other words, when they stop buying so much and the government continues to issue, that means that the price of the debt will go up. The price, I mean, will go down and interest rates will go up. And that's going to be a really interesting thing to see. That's typically the point where bull markets stumble. It's when the interest rates start to go up, and we saw the first bump up in interest rates. It's still, now I want to emphasize something here. The 10-year note, the 10-year treasury note, is still being issued at a negative real interest rate. Inflation is running between 1.3 and 1.7% a year. And since the 10-year note only pays 1.12% interest, it's actually a real negative interest rate. In other words, over the next 10 years, if we assume inflation doesn't change, then you would actually have the government paying you to borrow their money. Oh, that doesn't work right. The government basically is paying you to buy their debt. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Anyway,
they're paying an interest rate so that you loan them some money.
But you're actually paying the government money to hold that debt because the inflation in the dollar is scheduled to be, and in fact is, higher than the interest rate on the debt that you're purchasing. So when you buy a 10-year treasury note today, you will get less buying power back when it's returned to you at the tail end. Even if you reinvest all the interest along the way and you save all that interest along the way, you'll still wind up with less money, less buying power than you have today. And people are still buying them like mad. They're buying them every time. As soon as the government issues, they get overbid on the auction.
Yeah.
People are really willing to pay the government to loan the government money.
And his next question kind of dovetails nicely into that. His next question is, can you provide a summary of modern monetary theory? He says MMT and how we got here. All right. This is a little bit difficult because modern monetary theory was kind of developed with crayons. I'm saying that a little bit tongue-in-cheek. It is anybody that's really studied macroeconomics for very long looks at it and says modern monetary theory is not some kind of a new macroeconomic theory. It is a pipe dream. It's wishful thinking. So what is it? First, it says that the currency that we use, this is kind of the baseline, with the money that we use, is part of a public monopoly, that it is created by the government. And that's the first error in modern monetary theory. A lot of people on the right would agree with that the government creates money. They don't, and they really haven't for a very long time. They do print money. They do at the treasury mints, they do print dollars, they print all the way up to $100 bills, and they print all the coins, they press them all out, and it's very nice. But the Federal Reserve is much more in charge of how money is created, and it isn't the Federal Reserve saying to the U.S. government, and the Federal Reserve is a consortium of banks, just as a side note. It has some oversight from the government in that the Federal Reserve Board is appointed by the president, or has members that are appointed by the president and approved by the Senate. But money is created in banks. This is one of the either simplest or hardest things to understand in macroeconomics, is that in order to make money, new money that didn't exist before, loans have to be made and paid back. Value has to be created that people are willing to pay for and pay more than the cost of the item. So if we take a very simplistic view and say you've got $10,000 on deposit at the bank, you go to the bank and you say, I need $6,000 to buy a car, but I want to leave my deposits in place in case I need it. So can I get a loan from you for $6,000? Well, where did they get the $6,000 to loan you? This is very simplistic because they've got other deposits as well. But they got the $6,000 from your deposits and the other people at the bank's deposit. If we got really simplistic, it doesn't work this way, but it's easier to understand. They got the $6,000 from you to loan it back to you. And there's a lot of cases where people use a CD as collateral on a loan. They lock up the CD. They say, I'm not going to liquidate the CD for a year if you give me a year loan. Well, in that case, the money came directly from you to loan the money back to you. So then you paid the bank extra money to use that money. Where did that extra money come from? That's creation of money. When loans get paid back as they're contracted, a small amount of money is created. You get inflation when lots and lots of loans are being made at the same time and being paid back quickly, or at least the payments are coming in on those loans. You get deflation when people are unable to pay back their loans. It causes money to disappear out of the system. So if you're unable to pay back a loan, you consumed the value. That's the way it's looked at. If you're able to pay back the loan, you created extra value. You created an extra value that you were compensated for, so money's created. If we're creating more money, then we're creating value. We get inflation. And less money than we create value, we get deflation. What does that mean? If you raise your price on an item above what it was without changing the item, that's inflationary. It's the same item, and you say now it's got a higher price tag. That's inflationary if everybody's doing it at the same time. So modern monetary theory has this first concept that the government is in charge of the money supply. And the central bank is in charge of the money supply. That's the Federal Reserve, not the U.S. government. Because when the government does it, you get things like modern monetary theory. You get things, places like Greece, where the government says, we never have to pay back our debt. We'll just issue more debt to pay back the debt that we had before and then devalue the money that's in the debt. That's inflationary. A lot of banana republics do it. Why? Well, used to be everybody did it. But we've studied this enough to know that modern monetary theory is just the way that the French kings like Louis the 16th ran their government, which is to say you just keep borrowing money forever. And if they don't loan you the money, you just kill the people and take it.
Well, there's another argument to that. And I've read the arguments for modern monetary theory. And that is within limits, we can borrow pretty much money, as much money as we want to. And the Japanese have proved that. The Japanese have a national debt. The debt, the issued debt by their national government is like 212% rather of their GDP.
Yeah.
And they have not experienced any inflation. They've not experienced any degradation in that. In the matter of fact, the interest rates on their debt that they issue are still very, very tiny to negative. In other words, the people are willing to loan money to the government of Japan and pay the government of Japan to loan them money, which is backwards and upside down in traditional monetary theory, but it's going on. And when people look at that and say that's working, why would we not do it that way? And it's hard to argue with the fact that it's working. It all depends on the fact that there's enough people who want to loan money to an organization or a country that there's no limit to it.
Right. So let me break down modern monetary theory to the most basic sense. The most basic concept of it is that there's no end to the amount of money available to borrow. And that is generally true until the end happens. It's kind of like saying, I intend to live forever, so far so good. Okay, well, until you don't, and then you won't be around to say, I didn't. So this concept of modern monetary theory where you can just borrow more money, and if you get too much inflation, you just raise taxes and pull the money back out of the system. Except that that doesn't pull the money back out of the system. The government will spend it. You get more inflation that way. So modern monetary theory is it's kind of obfuscated with complexity, but it's a very simple concept that has been proven wrong repeatedly that works for long enough that people think, hey, it's working now, before it collapses.
It is the opposite extreme, and that's what goes on in our society today. We get extremes. One extreme is you have to balance the budget.
Yeah.
Federal government has, and that's something also that's proved historically to be not only impractical, but devastating. We tried running a balanced budget in the early part of the 20th century and wound up with a depression. The government does need to borrow money, and it does need to borrow a lot of money. The question is not so much whether it needs to borrow money to keep the economy healthy. The question is how much money should it borrow to keep the economy healthy? So there's two extremes. One is you can borrow an unlimited amount of money, and the other one is you shouldn't borrow money at all. And both of those extremes are devastating.
Yeah, and I had this conversation with a young soon-to-be military officer that was being offered a low-interest rate loan. It's a career starter loan that has a different label at different military institutions. But the idea is you can take this loan at a very low interest rate. Well, I had to explain good debt and bad debt. If you take debt and you use it to consume, like a credit card when you're buying your lunch, and you don't pay it off immediately, you're not paying for what you consumed as you use it. You're spreading that payment over a long period of time. And that's generally considered bad use of debt. If you gain a lot of debt because you were just consuming the thing that you were buying or whatever, it's a bad use of debt. Good use of debt is like the house. If you're buying a house, you can spread the payments over 30 years, which is generally the lifespan of a house. It's kind of the reason why the word mortgage exists. Mort means death in Latin. Gauge is a unit of measurement, death measurement. It's life expectancy of a house. So if you spread good debt is like the military spending. You're buying assets that will be useful for the coming years. That's a good use of debt. You can give small payments on something that you bought this year. You can have small payments on it going forward for the next 10 years. Bad use of debt would be spreading payments over 10 years for something that you used up and get no benefit of for 10 years. So there's good debt and bad debt at the governmental and personal level. And as you were just motioning emphatically, we've got to play some commercials. So we'll be back on the other end. We've got emails waiting at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back on the other side with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. Back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. We just got a few minutes left this hour. We got another hour coming up. I think we hit modern monetary theory, but you've got something to say. Go ahead.
Well, I want to say something that relates to the two questions that John asked us about modern monetary theory and federal debt purchases. Only it was actually the purchase by the Federal Reserve. One of the precepts of modern monetary theory is that if we get too much debt and people are not willing to borrow it, the Federal Reserve can. The Federal Reserve has the unlimited ability to create money and borrow and buy debt. Until it starts to create inflation, modern monetary theory says as long as there's very, very low inflation, borrowing as much money as you can is a good idea. It's not really an unlimited borrowing of money. It is as long as there's low inflation and the debt that the money that's being created by the federal government and the Federal Reserve is not creating inflation, then you can make as much money as you want to make and it's okay. And the rationale underlying that, which makes a lot of sense, is this is a global economy. and we don't run into constraints because always stuff can be made someplace else.
Now, that's why it's tempting. And they're using a time period from the end of the Great Recession, 2009, to now to say, hey, it worked for this period. We had this big stimulus. We're just spending lots of money. And look, there's no problem from it. That's the way, if you're a high net worth person, a lot of debt can be offered to you. Just think of the Michael Jackson situation. It's very similar to Greece. He had a lot of income coming in. He was doing his budget fairly well. Then he started borrowing lots and lots and lots of money and not making as much money, not bringing in as much revenue in while borrowing more money, and started paying his debt with other debt. And it nearly took him to bankruptcy. It's nearly taken Greece to bankruptcy. It's certainly taken Venezuela to bankruptcy. It is, in essence, a socialistic concept where the government has no limit to what they can borrow. It's an extreme. There's a seed of truth in every extreme, or it wouldn't hold up at all. So the truth is that since the Great Recession, we've borrowed a lot of money, and it doesn't seem to have had a negative effect on our economy. Well, that's the way it always starts when you're borrowing lots of money, and we're about out of time this hour. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail toll-free, should you use a landline, at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. There are real-life people there during the week and voicemail during the weekend. If you'd like to email us, you can at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got recordings of our radio program going back lots of years. We've got newsletters that you can sign up for. We've got a podcast that'll be listed on there next week. You can search for us on Audible and so on. So until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening.